This episode of FW Presents is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Since this episode is all about the legendary Irwin Hasen, two of the deals you can find on InStockTrades.com right now are All-Star Comics Archives Hardcover Volume 9. This is a hardcover collecting five classic JSA adventures, reprinting All-Star Comics 39 through 43. This archive edition has the JSA taking on the Justice Society, Professor Zodiac, and more, plus an introduction by Roy Thomas. It features art by Alex Toth, Carmen Infantino, Arthur Petty, and Irwin Hasen. Cannot beat that lineup. Normal price is $49.95. In-stock trades price is only $27.47. That's 45% off. Just that artistic lineup alone, how can you not pick this book up? All-Star Archives, Volume 9. And then the other book you can pick up is Comic Cavalcade Archives Hardcover, Volume 1. This new archive reprints the first three issues of one of comics' greatest Golden Age anthology titles from 1942 to 1943, Comic Cavalcade. Starring three superhero heavy hitters, Wonder Woman, The Flash, Green Lantern, and many more, these stories have never been reprinted. Comic Cavalcade is one of those weird titles that, again, just sort of fell down the memory hole. But it features stories by Gardner Fox, William Marston, Bill Finger, and art by, of course, Irwin Hasen, Harry G. Peter, Frank Godwin, Sheldon Moldoff, and others. This is a really fun book. If you ever look at these covers online, it always features Flash, Green Lantern, and Wonder Woman having like social adventures together, like having dinner or bringing Christmas presents to kids or running on races. It looks like a really fun book. And I've never read any of these stories because, as I mentioned, they've never been reprinted before. So Comic Cavalcade Archives Hardcover Volume 1, normal price $49.99. In-stock trades price is only $27.49. That is 45% off. So for these and all your other trade paperback needs, visit InStockTrades.com. We thank them for their support. And now, on with the show.
I was born in Harlem. I weighed a pound and a quarter. Pound and a quarter, and the doctor at the hospital, the women's hospital in New York, said if he survives, he'll be a genius. But he said, don't count on it. The cartoonists are like little children, even when they're 80. They're like children. They're old children. They've never lost the spell of being young. Cartoonists. Even the word cartoonist is a funny word.
Hello and welcome to FW Presents, the anthology show of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and if you're listening to this episode on the day it drops, July 8th, 2018, then today is the 100th birthday of the legendary cartoonist Irwin Hasen, co-creator of both Wildcat and the long-running comic strip Dondi. I was lucky enough to have Mr. Hasen as a teacher while I attended the Joe Kubert School from 1989 to 1992. And so did my guest, one of my oldest friends and former roommate, Sean Tiffany. Hello, Sean, and welcome to the Fire and Water Network.
Hello, Rob. It's been too long, far too long.
It has been far, far too long. Yes, Sean and my history is forever intertwined. As I mentioned, we were roommates the first year of the Kubert School at the really disgusting Clinton House.
Again, not as bad as other places I've seen, but yeah, not the best when you're coming from home.
Definitely not the best. And then we were roommates later on. We worked at the same graphic design studio. I actually replaced Sean at the graphic design studio.
He didn't kick me out, but I left willingly, and Rob came in after me.
Right. There you go. So yeah, our histories are forever intertwined. And so I just thought it would be really fun to have Sean on to talk about Irwin Hasen. Now, I will admit, to pull back the curtain a little bit, the original idea behind this episode was to be an episode of the Film and Water podcast to talk about the Dondi movie. Because, and I'm sure many of you were saying, what Dondi movie? Well, there was a live-action adaptation of the Dondi comic strip from 1961. It stars David Janssen, yes, the guy from The Fugitive. Patty Page and some other, Robert Strauss from Stalag 17 and some other actors. But, I had a chance to see the movie thanks to nuclear sub Chuck Coletta, who was kind enough to send me the Warner Archive DVD of the movie. I was never going to get around to getting it. But Chuck sent it to me, and I'm like, well, now's the perfect time to. I'm going to watch it, and we'll review it.
So this means I have to send it back now, since it's not even yours.
Well, you know, no, it's mine because Chuck sent it to me. The problem is with the Dondi movie, and the number one review I will give of the Dondi movie is it's a piece of shit.
I did watch it. You don't even know if I'd watch it. I did watch it. two nights ago. Okay. And I wouldn't say it's the worst thing ever. I would say it's, what, an hour and a half long? And the story could have been fit in about 20 minutes.
Yes, that's true. But before everybody gets mad at me, though, that review where I'm calling it a piece of shit, that came from Irwin himself.
Quote, unquote.
quote, unquote, that came from the man himself. Because one time in class, we were talking about movies or whatever, and he mentioned that there was a Dondi movie. And we were all like, really, there was? Because, of course, this is 1990, 91. Right. This is like, you know, pre-internet, so, you know, movies that if they weren't on home video, they just disappeared forever. And Dondi, to that point, had never been put on home video, so none of us had heard of this movie. And we were like, wow, there was a Dondi movie, that's so exciting. And so, you know, is it any good? And that was Irwin's one sentence review. It was a piece of shit. And
I was surprised he was in it. I didn't know he was in it.
He's in it. That's the thing. He is in the movie. There's a scene where they're looking for young Dondi, and they go to a police station, and there is a police sketch artist drawing Dondi. And in the corner, that's Irwin. Yep. He's sitting there drawing.
And other
Dondi
than his hair, you know, being darker at a younger age, I'm like, he hadn't changed at all. He looked the same as when we had him as a teacher.
Right. For any of you who are wondering what Irwin looked like, if you've ever seen any of the Guardians of the Universe,
exactly.
from the Green Lantern Corps, that's what Irwin looked like. Now, Irwin, of course, was involved in the original Green Lantern. He drew some of that comic book in the 40s. And so I have no proof of this, but I'm betting
right.
that Gil Kane, when it came time to design the Guardians of the Universe.
To Irwin, based the Guardians off of him. Because, yeah, you would have been like, if I needed to cast a Guardian in a movie, it'd be Irwin.
Right. Yeah, because Irwin was like 4'10".
Yep, put him in a robe, put a Green Lantern symbol on the front. Yeah. You'd be like, done. We're done.
Exactly. I mean, white hair on the sides. It looks exactly like him. So, all right. So now I was waiting on air to find whether you actually did watch the Dondi movie, because I sent it to you like 6 months ago.
Oh, yeah.
And you were like, oh, my God, I don't ever watch it, because it really is not a good movie. But you did watch it.
I did. I finally, because again, knowing this interview was coming up and us talking was coming up, I'm like, okay, I better watch this thing. And I was going to watch like maybe half an hour of it just to kind of try it, because you were like, it's really bad. But I ended up watching the whole thing. The first thing is, it's an awful DVD experience, because the way that like the chapters are set up or not set up, or, you know, any of the, like, if you stop the movie, you're like, you're screwed. You got to start over again. There's no fast forward almost. There's no chapter headings. There's nothing to kind of indicate where you are in the story. I mean, it's you saw it on this format. It almost felt like the equivalent of a VHS tape, the way it was set up.
Right. I mean, the Warner Archive discs are pretty cheaply done, right, because they're basically produced as to order. You order one and then they run it.
Oh,
off.
Really?
It's a way of them getting really obscure titles available at the cheapest way possible. So I can understand that, like, there's no special features, there's no trailers,
and again,
there's nothing. It's just,
I love that
we
live in an age where you can access stuff like that, but I'm like, God, a little effort, a little more. And not even that I need special features or, you know, director's commentary or some kind of archival commentary, but just a little better, just interface for me to get in and out of the movie. Because I don't know if I stopped it at one point or did something. I tried to do something to adjust my TV and I had to start all over again. And I'm like, fuck, I got to watch this thing over again? This whole starting again? It's not like fast forward. But for me, it's funny because I don't know, even having Irwin as a teacher, I didn't know the history of Dondi. I didn't know the story of Dondi.
Right.
So I went in going, I know it's this button, you know, this Annie, little orphan Annie looking boy. But other than that, I'm like, I have no idea what the story is. So I went in knowing nothing. So maybe that's why for me it wasn't as bad a story, because I had no idea what it was about.
I guess. I mean, I just found the movie so boring. I mean, first of all, look, it stars, as I mentioned, David Janssen from The Fugitive. But of course, the main character is Dondi, played by this little kid named David Corey. And the kid, David Corey, is an absolutely atrocious actor. Now, it's not his fault. He was a little kid. He was directed by, noted auteur Albert Zugsmith, whose name indicates what kind of movies he made. And so it's not this kid's fault that he's bad. It's the director's fault. But nevertheless, he's awful. I mean, the camera just... Albert Zugsmith just points the camera at this kid and is like, just be cute.
Right.
And he's just terrible. So every scene of Dondi, you're just like, oh my God, please show me any other character.
Well, is the thing
is so
where
awful.
He would say, like, everyone like, hey, Mr. Kelly, buddy, is that a Dondi thing or is that a movie thing?
I have no
we
idea.
We called everyone buddy. Like, everyone was like, hey, GI buddy. Hey, Miss So-and-so buddy. You know, like, all right, that's interesting. Interesting choice. I don't know if that came from the strip or not. So I can't. And here's...
I mean,
Here's what fascinated me, because you watched this, what, 6 months ago, a year ago?
Something like that, yeah.
Watching it now in the Trump era where we're separating parents from kids, it was weird to watch because I'm like, God, this movie is like Dondi basically gets adopted by GIs. He sneaks aboard the ship. He gets into the port in New York. He's separated from his friends in the military. And basically the whole town is like, we must find Dondi. He's so special. He is so – we. How dare we treat an immigrant this way? We must find him and take care of him. And I'm like, God, if they remade this movie now and put it like on the Mexican border, it would be the hunt for Dondi to incarcerate him. as Donnie's making his way around America, marveling at all the wonders we have. It would just be everyone in their power trying to cage this boy up. And I'm like, this would be the worst remake ever if they did Dondi again. And I don't
He is treated right. He is treated like a special little mop. Everybody does love exactly. Dondi in the movie. That's true.
Exactly. And it's just him kind of the wondering, and it'd almost be like E.T. where he'd be chased by the government now trying to dissect him if it was, you know, made in this era.
Oh my God. This episode took a dark turn very early.
I watched it with that in mind going, God, how much we've changed. Maybe not, you know, cause we did turn away a lot of people during World War II as well, but just to kind of see it in the light of what we're going through now and to see like the hopefulness of America at that point going, we should embrace people and help people to now separating people and caging children basically. So, and again, and even to see Dondi at the end of the movie in a cage, I'm like, this is weird. This is very weird to watch this.
That's amazing. Cause right. I didn't have any of those thoughts. Cause of course, when I watched it, we didn't hear about any of this stuff. So I didn't know about it. Yeah. I mean, the Dondi comic strip is one of those, it ran for 30 years.
And I read like, Wikipedia page where they kept kind of updating it. Where it was like, oh, it was World War II. Now it's the Korean War. Now it's Vietnam where he was separated from his parents. So I found it amazing that they kind of kept trying to keep it contemporary with the story instead of just going, well, it's a period piece and that's, we're just going to keep it that way.
Right. Right. Yeah. Cause I mean, otherwise you would have to have Dondi would be like an adult by this point. You got to keep him a kid. I mean, and Irwin drew every single strip
really
for 30 years, which is, he's the only artist credited on Dondi.
And when did it end? When did it finally end?
1986.
Okay. So it was before.
So he started, you know, we had him in 1990, 91. So it only had been wrapped up a couple of years before that.
Was he doing anything else work-wise that you know of other than teaching at the Kubert School and SVA?
I don't know.
Just
I mean,
teaching
one of
at
the,
that point.
I know you and I heard these stories about that. Like, he made a ton of money at conventions.
Right.
I mean, I think you heard this story too, where like he was, and for everybody, we're kind of jumping around a little bit, but I can't help it just because it was kind of amazing to have this guy that had been through it all and seen it all. And of course, him and Joe Kubert were longtime friends. There was like a picture of them when they were like 18 and 17 or something. And like Irwin goes up to like Joe's waist or whatever it is. But there was this famous story about where, of course, like, eventually the IRS started getting wind of the fact that Comic-Cons were these money pots for artists. And so much of it was done in cash. And of course, most of that income was not recorded. So there was this thing where we had heard this story where, because Irwin used to wear these like,
he was like,
what were they, Sean? They were like bomber jackets, but it was like a flak jacket that had like a ton of pockets.
But it would have been super fashionable in like 1972. His stuff.
Yeah, his style.
Big collars, and just something like, well, this has been in the closet for 20 years. Okay.
Right. I mean, I imagine finding a hard time finding clothes for a man that's 4'10". You know what I mean? It's like, that's not everybody has those. But I mean, the story we had heard was, you know, eventually the IRS agents started coming to these cons at the end of the show and they would start questioning people.
Right.
You know, they'd be like, well, how much money did you make? And the famous, like Irwin, of course, by the time that he was doing conventions, most of the people that would want to sketch from Irwin Hazen were older people. So they had more money.
Right.
They weren't a 15-year-old. 15-year-old doesn't care about Irwin Hazen. 15-year-old's there for Frank Miller or Rob Liefeld.
Exactly. And this is a guy who, again, helped do the Green Lantern, created Wildcat.
Wildcat, right, exactly. So if you're going to him for a commission and he's charging $50 a commission, you're like, that's fine because you're this legendary figure. So Irwin would have literal pockets full of cash. And at one point, at one convention, he literally saw the IRS guy coming
and
just folded up his tent and ran. And they said, people said that were there. You could literally see this little guy running with money just flying out of his pockets.
He's just like one of those guys on the beach in Coney Island with his little setup, who would just run at any sign of the cops, you know, like,
no. Yeah, yeah. I love that idea that he was just like, screw you guys, I'm out of here. Although, the guy had, I mean, again, for those of you that are like, this show is not going to be a detailed history of Irwin's career. For that, you can find, first of all, there's a book, he wrote a book about himself called Loverboy, which is all about him and his romance, because apparently Irwin had a lot of game.
Well, I'm amazed that the guy was born and died in Manhattan, which to me is fascinating. That you could actually live your whole life in New York City.
Yes.
Because for me, it's a place you almost move there and then you move away. You had your time in New York City and then you go somewhere else. You don't live your whole life there.
He must have loved it. I mean, there's a documentary about him. You can see the trailer for it on YouTube. And the movie is called Irwin Hazen, A New York Story.
Right.
So, I mean, there it is. I mean, he spent his whole time doing this kind of stuff, except for when he was in the service. So, for like the detailed history of Irwin's career, you can consult those sources. He did win a National Cartoonist Society Story Comic Strip Award for Dondi 2 years running, 1961 and 1962, which is amazing. One of the things that he loved to do, and while we were at the Kubert School, have imitations of our teachers, you know, as we got to know everybody. And the one phrase that Irwin used to... Go ahead. Why don't you tell everybody? What was the thing that Irwin loved to say?
Like, put Batman in there. Put Batman in there. Everything. Like, put Batman in there. I'm like, what? Okay. And it's funny because looking back and not... Again, I almost wish I could go back now to school and appreciate it more. Because at the time, you almost felt like Irwin had checked out. He'd almost been like, you know, if you want to come to me and ask questions, I'll be happy to tell you anything you want to know. But for me to actually be up here and lecture and be a teacher, I think I'm done with it. So I wish I had taken more advantage of almost every teacher we had and just got more information out of everyone.
Right. I totally agree with that. I mean, I did not, I will admit, I was 19, 20, and I did not have an appreciation for a guy like Irwin Hazen. He did seem kind of out of date. And you mentioned like the clothes and stuff. And like, you know, he drew Dondi. And at that age, I was like, what the hell's Dondi? Right. I mean, nobody even really knows what Dondi is now because Dondi has disappeared down the memory hole. There's no collections of it anywhere. It's not like Dick Tracy.
Too bad.
Peanuts.
That's too bad. They should have. You know. I mean, if you'd think in this day and age, they would have collections somehow. Like Kitchen Sink Press, IDW, or someone would put together something.
Right, exactly, exactly. It's one of those strips that's just, I mean, again, for a strip that ran for 30 years and it was so popular they made a movie out of it at one point, you would think that it would have some cultural currency, but I guess it just doesn't right now. But I would admit, you're completely right, John. Irwin was somebody that was like, if you want to hear my stories and you want to learn, you can come walk up to the front of the room and I'll tell you. But if you're not, I'm not going to. And a lot of us didn't.
Well, I think that's you and I, too, we came right out of high school, went right to the school there. And the place was run so much like a high school, you were used to like, you teach me or I'm going to try and get away with not working at all. You know, because still that high school mentality.
Yes.
And it was funny because a friend of mine went to like just community college, like a film school, you know, just like how to use whatever After Effects or something like that. And it was funny seeing it from his perspective at like 30 years old to go into school and being taught. And everyone's like, okay, we're going to wrap it up early today. Everyone gets out an hour and a half early. And everyone's like, yay. And my friend's like, no, I'm paying you for this time. You sit and you teach me, you know. So it's almost like a different point of view is when you're different ages is when you're learning stuff. So I definitely wish I could go back now and just take way more advantage of what we had.
Right. And I mean, the one person that I feel like I did take some advantage mean, but like I wish that I actually did consult was Tex Blaisdell.
Right.
Because Tex lived with us.
Right.
Tex lived in the Clinton house on Thursday nights because he taught Thursdays and Fridays. So he was in our kitchen.
Right.
And he was the guy. I mean, I've told the story. I don't mean to get off Irwin, but I mean, I've told the story on other episodes of different podcasts where, because I caught Tex at a particular moment, he had me like partly ink a panel in a Justice League comic. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm getting to touch an actual comic book page. And like, I'm putting lines down that will be printed.
Right. I remember something like that. It was such a big deal when you were like 19 years old, you know.
Oh my God, I was terrified. You know what I mean? And that was because Tex was in our kitchen and you couldn't escape him. You know, it was like you'd get up to go get a snack and there he is.
Just sitting there working at the kitchen.
Right.
Table.
And you're like, well, tell me stories, Tex. And he would. And he would tell you stories because you were more in that comfort zone of like you're in your home as opposed
to
being in the classroom.
At the same time, I can't think of one teacher we had that was unapproachable. That was just like, oh my God, this guy is so mean. There's no way I'm going to go talk.
No, yeah, they were all nice.
So,
yeah.
And again, for me, and maybe I'll bring this up now or later, but having taught at the Kubert School later,
That's right. I should mention you taught there. Yes.
I taught there a few years before I moved out to Colorado. It was interesting to just sit in the teacher's lounge with people like Irwin and Hi Eisman, and listening to their stories was the funniest thing I've ever heard. Like at one point, Irwin told this detailed story about the first time he ever got laid. And it was like where his friend knew he didn't get laid, so he brought him to a hooker for the first time, which I guess I don't know if that was ever, a commonplace thing to do. Maybe it was back in the day. But he said he was so scared that he actually shit his pants. And he took the underwear off and like threw it out the window and it like fell into a tree. So after he was done, he was walking by and he just saw his pants sitting in the tree. And dude, I was on the floor almost like laughing so hard at this stupid story. I'm like, where was this Irwin when I was being taught? And it was just such a detailed, great storytelling, just him telling the story around the table. Oh my God. And the whole, like, Joe Kubert was there on the floor laughing. Everyone was just busting out. It was the funniest thing I've ever heard. I'm like, this is the greatest thing I've ever done. I mean, you know, just to hang out with these guys and hear this story was the best thing. It was like the best day ever.
Oh, yeah. You've never told me that story. That's insane. Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah. I really wish that we had a chance to observe the one story that I've
told. It's not like you want to be a teacher going, here's impressionable kids. Let me tell them about the first time I got laid by a hooker. You know?
Well, that's true. You don't be the one story that I've told, I think on other shows, and it involves you, me, and our mutual friend Dan.
Yes.
This was the thing that
I want to tell you my point of view from this story once you tell it.
Okay, great. Okay, this is the thing that pissed me off about Irwin because the assignment was to draw a house in three seasons. And the whole idea was, of course, to maintain an artistic consistency from house to house to house. But then, you know, you'd have the differences of the different seasons. So that was the whole idea. And it's like, okay. So, and you and I were not roommates at this point because we were out of the Clinton
house. Second year of school, yep.
At this point. Right, we're right. So anyway, we come in the next week because the classes were weekly. We come in. Now mine, I don't even remember what I did. Mine was pretty lame, as was most of the assignments that I did. Mine was just kind of just forgettable. Dan Eaker, our mutual buddy, he drew three houses that were like architecturally perfect.
Right.
I mean, like you could just print those and be like, just build a house. These are like blueprints. These are so perfect. He killed himself on this assignment.
But at the same time, and then to be honest, he didn't push the seasons too much.
Right.
I remember.
Right. Right. But the man hours that he put in was just staggering.
I agree.
Right. So there was that. And then so there was mine. So then you walk in with one drawing, just one drawing, because everybody had done three drawings.
Which was the assignment. The assignment was to draw three drawings of three.
We'd do three drawings. Yeah. You walk in with one goddamn drawing of one house cut up into three panels. Yeah. And it's the like fall in one panel, winter in second panel, and summer in the third panel. And Dan and I are like, oh, you are going to get roasted because you cheated. All of us have three drawings. You did one drawing. You are going to get your ass handed to you. So we're reviewing the drawings. We're up at the front of the room, and everybody's got their things. We get to mine, and Irwin's just – I don't even remember what Irwin said. It wasn't memorable because my piece was not memorable. We get to Dan's, and we're expecting Irwin to fall all over himself because it's like, oh, my God, these things are so perfect.
Because Dan followed the assignment to the letter. It looked like what he wanted.
Absolutely, to the letter. And so he looks at Dan's and he was like, pretty good. And we're like, that's it?
But didn't he also push the seasons weren't kind of pushed enough? He didn't push enough.
Okay. All right. Okay. That part I don't remember. So then we get to yours. And Dan and I are like rubbing our hands in glee because you're going to get roasted. Irwin looks at your thing and he's like, this is brilliant. We're like, what?
I'm a goddamn genius.
And we look over at you and you have this smile on your face. You're like, yep, like son of a bitch.
Now, from my perspective, I knew I did it wrong. I knew I did not do it the correct way. I had run out of time. I think it was one of the first assignments. Like we were taught in Kubert, like you must ink with a brush. You must ink with rapidographs and all these proper tools. You must color with watercolors or Dr. Martin's dyes or acrylics. You must use all the proper tools an artist uses. And I did this piece, and I was like, I'm going full. I don't have enough time. I know I'm going to chintz this thing out. I think I inked the whole thing with markers, colored it all with markers. I'm like, I'm going full as badly an impersonation of Bill Watterson as I can get with how fast can I go. And, you know, I split it into three panels. And I thought I was done. I thought there's no way this is going to fly. And you and Dan did not help at all by telling me, like, I'm screwed. You're screwed. I'm like, oh, man, I'm screwed. So it wasn't like a smile of like, ha ha, I knew it. I knew I'd get away with it. It was more relief than like, oh, my God, I got away with it. How did I not get thrown out of this class forever? Fuck this school. You know, code of conduct, you did not use brushes and you didn't follow the rules. But I was like amazed that I'm like, oh, my God, okay. Because I thought I was done. I thought that was going to be the worst thing I'd ever done. So that I actually pulled it off. I was like, oh, thank God.
The thing that we learned over time, and you learn what you become a professional,
right,
is get it done. Right. If it isn't done, if you're going into the life of a commercial artist, if it isn't done, it's worthless.
Right.
It doesn't matter how beautiful it is.
I agree.
If it isn't done at deadline, who cares?
Right. I've said something, and I've almost come up with this in the last couple of years, where like good and bad is it's an interpretation. You can interpret whether something's right, good or bad. Done and not done, that's set in stone.
Exactly.
You'd rather have something done and bad, because at least if it's bad and done, you can at least go, well, what do you want changed? What can I fix?
Right.
If it's not done, there's just no point to it. So
right. If you want to be a fine artist and you're like, I only create when the spirit strikes me, right, then that's fine. Good luck with that.
And you and I were not taught that way. You and I were taught, like, just get something on the page. Get something done.
Yeah, just get it done.
Which is why I think, like, you and I could, like, I do the 24-hour comic day now, which to me is like, that's easy. That's all we've ever been taught to do, is like, just get something on the page in 24 hours. Doesn't matter if it's good or bad, but have it done. And
right. Right.
I consistently like finish before everyone. I'm like, I'm done by midnight. Like, I'm done. I'm going home now, you know? And at one time I actually went in there. I do it at a comic book store, and I went in one year and I just penciled the thing, then came home and took a nap, and then went back and inked it that night. And the owner's like, you went home? I'm like, dude, I don't work for you. You know, I don't work here. I can do whatever I want. And I got the thing done still like hours before anyone else did. So it's just, yeah, I think it's that ingrained just commercial artist that we've been put through that school.
Right. And when I did the portraits for Time Out in New York, the celebrity interview portraits, I did that every week for 5 years. And I never missed a single one. I never blew a single deadline. And some of them are terrible. I am sure some of the people that got that magazine as a subscription, you know, read that column and they're like, oh my God, this guy's all, you know, this guy's terrible. But it was like, but I'm the one that has to get it done.
Right.
And it got done. It got,
well, it's also like you say, like I did one every week. It's like, and it makes it sound like, well, once a week I'd get one done, but it's like, no, sometimes they're like, hey Rob, we need this by tomorrow morning.
Yes,
you know, we sat on this until the last hour. Now it's up to you.
It happened a lot. Yeah.
So there's times like that, which I don't think anyone would have looked at those and said, that one's bad. You might look back on them and say they're bad. But I can't imagine anyone looking at those and being disappointed with them. I mean, you did great work.
Maybe.
So.
Maybe so. But I mean, that was something that when you're younger and you're not there yet, you're not doing things.
But you're never on
deadline for money.
Right.
I think Irwin, having been in the industry for 50 years by that point, right, or 40 years, he was concerned with teaching his students to get it done.
Right.
And you got it done.
Right.
You got it done in a creative and efficient way. And then, like, again, we joked about the whole put Batman in it.
Right.
That was kind of Irwin's marketing sense of like, well, if you have a drawing, but if you put Batman in it, you might be able to sell it to somebody that wants a Batman drawing. And it was easy to make fun of him, but he realized that was him on the commercial side of it. Of like, well, if you're going to do this drawing, make it something that somebody might want to buy, because that's why you're here, is to make money. And when you're younger and you're kind of more pure, you know, you don't have that appreciation. It's only when you get older and you're like, well, shit, I got to get this done, or I'm not going to pay rent this month.
Well,
even when I taught,
one of the things I actually did a lesson where I'm like, I don't even care what it looks like. I just want you to have it done on time and follow the directions.
Yep.
I want it done to this size. I want it done, and not even like, you can do any style you want. You could have it pencil, ink, whatever, as long as it's the right size and done on time. Because I'm like, that's the most important thing. You know, you can't sell like someone wanting, like, I want a full page spread 8.5 by 11. You're like, well, here's my, you know, 8 by 8 piece, and it's not done on time. I'm like, that doesn't work. So I was trying to drill into them, like, it doesn't matter what it looks like as long as it's done on time and at least fits the specifications someone wants.
You know, when we were at Qbert, one of the things you had to do is, because we had 10 assignments every week, is that you started to like ration
right.
your time. You know, there were some that you were like, look, I don't care about this assignment, so I'm going to bang it out. And then there were other ones that you really did care about, and that's what you spent all your time doing. Right. You learned, you know, you kind of be like, well, yeah. this one I really want to I really want to blow their socks off.
And you really found your strengths there. What were your strengths? What could you lean into? Like lettering. I was awful at lettering, so I couldn't have throw those over to Tom and be like, Tom, letter this for me.
Yes, we often hand the lettering over to Tom Zoller. Yeah.
So, but you'd find your strength and you kind of lean into those. And I think that was one of the great things about the school is not that it would teach you everything, but it would kind of help focus you, A, on whether you really want to do this or not. Because I know there were a bunch of people we went to school with who were like, oh, comic books really isn't for me. I cannot hack it in this world. It's not what I thought it would be like. And dropped out. But it would teach you kind of what your strengths are and also what your weaknesses were and kind of how to deal with both of them. So again, it's a great school, and I wish I could go back and learn more from it now, because I still go back. There was something, okay, I don't know if you had this. I think it was first year we had Ben Ruiz as a figure drawing teacher. So you had Ben at some point for a figure.
Oh, I did. I had Ben. Yeah.
At some point, did he ever bring up to you, like, here's the 7 times you can actually draw a line on a piece of paper? Like it's a plane break or a color break, or he had like a list of reasons why you could draw a line. And I want to go back and like, I want to write those down because I'm so curious about what those things were now. Mm-hmm. And it's not something I can even Google and be like, when are the times I can draw a line on a piece of paper, according to Ben Ruiz? Like, that's not something I can Google and get that information anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I mean, yeah, most of my assignments are gone. I've lost them over time or whatever, but I remember every so often.
I'm sure I still have one of the Jesus pages you did though.
Oh, no, don't even. Oh, all right. You know what? Let's tell that story while we're here. Why not? Whatever the opportunity. Talk about banging something out. Okay. We had an assignment for Joe Kubert, and it was 3 pages to draw the crucifixion.
Right.
That was to tell the story of the crucifixion in 3 pages. Okay. Now you mentioned people that learned that they didn't want to – they thought they wanted to do comics, and then they got there, and they realized they didn't want to do comics, and they dropped out. Well, I was the middle step. I got there and I realized I thought I wanted to do comics. And once I realized what it really entailed, I realized I didn't want to do it, but I didn't drop out.
Just to go offline a little bit, do you wish you'd gone to another school? Or do you think that was the good school for you, for how you?
Well, I mean, that's hard to say. I mean, I learned, the thing I learned from the Kubert School, and this was something that I inherited from my mother because my mom is just like this, and then I think the Kubert School kind of like weaponized it, is just I am really highly organized.
Right.
Really, I mean, people marvel about like how many podcasts like I'm able to produce in a given period of time, and that's because I'm just really organized. And I think if I hadn't gone to the Kubert School and I had been more of a loosey-goosey type place.
Right.
I might not have learned those skills. And, you know, look, for the years that I did do freelance illustration, I did freelance illustration part-time for 5 years, and then I did it full-time for 10.
Right.
You know, I never missed a single deadline, ever once, no matter how big the assignment was, no matter, you know. And I'm proud of that.
Right. That comes right out of the Kubert School. It's just that way of thinking.
Right, exactly. And so I don't regret having gone there or staying there, because it taught me other life skills that I'm able to apply. I mean, hell, being as organized as I am works out at the job I'm at now, which is not a creative job, but I'm highly organized and I get more done than a lot of other people. But anyway,
I wonder if going back, you realize it taught you more about not just how to draw or how to paint, but like how to be a working artist is the biggest lesson it gave you.
Yes, it did. It did, because I realized, and I've said this, I said this in the introduction to your Exit 6 book, which we'll get to at the end of the show, where like, okay, I remember the first day at the Clinton House, and everybody had moved in at that point, and there was like all these different, Dan O'Connor and Chuck Von Schaff and Tom Ryder and you and all these, and everybody, right? And we all get together, and of course, we're all meeting each other for the first time, and we're all like, well, let's see each other's work.
Right.
And we all pull out pages, and you pulled out the early embryonic versions of Exit 6. And I remembered thinking, oh, shit, I'm already behind. We haven't even had day one of the classes yet, and I'm already behind because look how good this guy – I mean, the work is nowhere near what it would become.
Right.
You would develop, and the stuff you're doing now is better than the stuff you did for Exit 6. But nevertheless, you were light years ahead of me already, and I'm like, oh, I'm doomed. I'm just doomed. And I had to learn to try and find other avenues to pursue my creativity because I was never going to make it as a comic book artist.
I think you and I both had that drive where I didn't think I was the best either. There was far better artists, I think, in our class. But I would argue that you and I were probably more successful at doing art than some people who are way better than us.
Yes, well, that is true. And this is another story that I've mentioned on other episodes. There was a guy there, and I won't mention his name because who knows where he is now. But there was another guy there who I saw. He was never in one of my classes. He was in one of the other classes. But I walked into the other class once, and he was drawing Spider-Man, right? He was just drawing a figure of Spider-Man swinging. And he was finishing the inks, and it was, like, exquisite. It looked like a John Romita Spider-Man. Right. It was perfect. And I remembered asking him, and I'm like, my God, man, that is just – friggin' killer. And I was like, how long did it take you? And he's like, oh, this took me a week. And I'm like, if it takes you a week to draw one figure, that's right. Useless.
Right.
John Romita can do six pages
in a day. Exactly.
So, you know, I mean, I'm glad that you can draw the Spider-Man that good, but no one will pay you for that because it's impossible. So anyway, okay, I'm getting offside. The Jesus
pages.
Joe Kubert had us draw the crucifixion. So, okay. I knew that any comic book continuity I had to draw, I was screwed because I was never going to be as good as everybody. I was always going to be in the bottom third of the class. So I'm like, what am I going to do? So this was the time when I had an apartment with my roommate, and then we had a sort of a next door apartment to Tom Zoller and his roommate, and Tom and I would sit in his living room and watch TV and work on our lap boards. So I remember drawing the pages, and like at the crucifixion, I had like 27 people being crucified, and apparently it was only three.
Well, it's a remake, you know, you get to up the ante for the 90s, you know.
I showed the page to Tom, and Tom is a religious person, and Tom was like, yeah, Rob, you have like a convention going on there. It was three guys. I'm like, oh, okay. So I had to erase the other like 19.
You should have been like, not in my book. In my book, there are 19 dudes. And let's discuss theology now. Come on, let's go.
Right. So anyway, but I realized that I was never going to be able to do this right. So I decided to like go artsy.
Right.
And I was inspired by Bill Sienkiewicz's Elektra Assassin miniseries that Frank Miller wrote, where all of his background figures were these sort of surrealistic shapes.
And you already started doing like more collage stuff at this point, yes?
Right, exactly. Yes, I had. So I was like, okay, I'm going to – now the problem with that is if you want to imitate a great artist like Bill Sienkiewicz, you have to have skills of Bill Sienkiewicz to get close. And I obviously didn't have those skills. And so – the first page I did was actually, I don't think it was terrible, but it was weird. And then I realized by the time I got the second page, this wasn't working, and I just banged it out. So by the time I got to the third page, it was just an absolute abortion. And I remembered showing my pages at the front of the class, and I was just praying that Joe Kubert would just blow by them, because I was like, I couldn't tolerate the idea of this legendary figure just ripping me a new one because these pages were so bad. Now, luckily, like, I think he just dismissed them. He was like, well, I kind of have to see what you're going for, but I don't think it really worked. Blah, blah. And I was like, fine, whatever. I'll take the F. Just please.
Right.
And the pages were so bad that I decided that, much like the Infinity Stones, they could not be contained in all the same place. So I gave each of my friends one page each.
Well, I think you used this wrapping paper for presents for us.
I did wrap one gift using one of the pages.
So I think I have to have that page somewhere in my portfolio.
Oh, dear God. Oh, that's a terrifying thought. It's just the worst. So, but I mean, I just was so out of my league at that point. And like you mentioned, I had started doing like collage stuff because I was like, that's kind of where my head was at.
Right.
That was something that was inspired me, and I could compete on my own level as opposed to worrying about what you or Dan O'Connor or Scott Collins. I mean, Scott Collins was in our class. Scott Collins is like a big deal now in the world of comics. Like, that's how far along some of these people were. And I just was like, yeah, I'm doomed here. So that's just, this is kind of what it was.
Well, it's funny too, it's coming out of Kubert, is there's not a, like, speaking of Scott, who is a big to-do in comics now, there's not a lot of, like, you never hear of a famous, really famous artist coming out of Kubert, other than like not in our class or nothing. I never hear of someone coming out like after us, you know, who's a well-known superstar. But I guarantee at least half of the students who came out of there are working artists somehow.
Right.
You know, so while we were not taught to be superstars, we were taught to be working artists. And I don't know if that's a detriment or a positive thing, you know. Actually,
I guess it depends on what you want. I mean, I'm obviously for the Kubert School, it's better for them if they launch, you know, the next huge guy.
Right. But at the same wouldn't you rather be like, out of the 20 years we've been here, we've launched three huge names? Or would you be like, hey, you know, what if they said 90% of people who come out of here get at least one art job when they're done? And probably more than half are actually working artists at the moment.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I would think it'd be better as a teaching thing to be like, look, you don't have to be, you know, the next big superstar, but you can make a living doing this being someone no one's ever heard of. And arguably you and I are people no one's ever heard of, but we've made a living doing art for years.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, at my current job, when I've mentioned to somebody, I don't bring it up a lot, but when it's endemic to the conversation, I've mentioned, I did freelance illustration for 10 years. And they're like, oh, really? And then they'd be like, did you ever work for anybody that you have heard of? And I'm like, well, I did the NBA All-Star Game, right, and Margaret Cho and the ESPN. And their eyes go wide because they're just like, really? I'm like, yeah, you know, yeah, nobody's ever heard of me, but nevertheless, yeah, I had big clients and it paid the bills and it fed the family. And that was, yeah, I mean, like you wouldn't go, because Qbert, there was no romance at the Qbert school. The place was, you know, kind of run down and, you know, whatever. And it wasn't in like, there wasn't anything to do in the neighborhood.
I would say arguably my high school, like Voc Tech class had higher aesthetic to it than the Qbert school did.
Right.
And it's
but
funny.
You were there to learn.
Right.
But you were there to like grind it out. And if you were someone that wanted to grind it out, then it was the place for you.
And to explain like Dover, it was funny. I was trying to explain Dover to Monica at one point. She's like, I thought that would have been like the most lily white place you could live. And I'm like, let's go to YouTube. And I found this one. It was a great video. And I'm like, it was incumbent of everything I remember about Dover outside of the school was just two dudes driving around Dover in their car, which was great to just see them drive around the streets they used to live in. But just speaking Spanish, blasting like, you know, mariachi music on the freaking radio. And I'm like, that is the Dover I remember. And it was awesome.
And I mean, part of it too, is that we were all, most of us at least, were underage.
Right.
And so it wasn't like you could go out and, you know, go drink,
right,
you know, or go do a lot of really crazy partying. Although, you know, a lot of the guys did, I didn't, cause I was like one of the nerdlingers, even among the Qbert school. But yeah, I mean, yeah, you really kind of just were stuck inside,
right,
at your drawing board. And again, if that was not the life for you,
yeah, but again, that's what kind
then,
of school
then
also,
you don't want to stay there.
Right. The school also gave that to you. Like there was more than enough stuff to do. It wasn't like you were like, I have a ton of free time, you know,
yeah.
Never.
I pulled many an all-nighter. Yeah, absolutely. You know, just trying to get it all done. So, I mean, that's what it was. And like you said, it is a shame that, you know, there's that phrase, youth is wasted on the young,
oh, yeah,
where it's like, yeah, I wish I had spent more time talking to Irwin,
right,
and just telling, just hearing stories, just hearing like, you know, my God, I mean, again, the guy co-created Wildcat, like a character that I've heard of, you know, I mean, I remember like he drew the listing for Wildcat in Who's Who, which is like, that series is like one of my touchstones of my youth. And had I, like, I would have been like, what? I would have had him like sign my copy.
Right.
I would have been like, oh my God, Irwin, you know, like I'm being taught by the guy that drew this, that did this, that co-created this character that I've heard of, has been in, and later on now Wildcat is like, you know, in cartoons and stuff.
Right.
And I'm like, This is a guy that drew Wonder Woman professionally. This is a guy that's drawn Flash professionally. This is a, I mean, again, I'm watching the Dondi movie, and even though the movie is terrible, there he is.
Right.
You know, there's a guy that I had conversations with in a movie.
Well, but even with like Irwin, like say you don't, you know, didn't treat Irwin with the respect he definitely deserved. Even Joe Kubert was someone I didn't really have a knowledge of going in, you know? So I probably didn't treat him with the reverence he should have been treated with. But maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it's better to not be like, oh my God, it's Joe Kubert, I can't go talk to him. It's like, no, there's that dude who knows way more than I do, and he's helping me figure out how to draw water with a brush, you know?
Right, yeah. I was never able to talk to Joe that much because I was just too intimidated. Like, I was just too scared of him, you know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, again, it was, I do want to do an episode on the podcast about Tex Blaisdell because we had some great times.
So I never had Tex for a teacher, though, too, which is weird. I never had him as a teacher.
Oh, I'd love to. The best, again, we're getting off Irwin, but like the best thing I can remember hearing about Tex was when, because this one time, I think it was before the Christmas break,
mm-hmm,
and his daughter came by to pick him up, and like they were going to go, like he was going to spend time with his daughter for the holidays or something. So he was still teaching us when she showed up.
Right.
So she came to the school, and she showed up in our classroom. And we were like, and he's like, this is my daughter, and I forget her name. And she was like, oh, hi, everybody. And so we're like, tell us Tex stories. Tell us Tex stories. What is it like? I mean, Tex, because Tex was this, for anyone who doesn't know, you actually, okay, if you ever want to see what Tex Blaisdell looks like, go to YouTube, because Tex Blaisdell was on a game show. He was on What's My Line.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can, and like, it's in color. It's like from like 1960, because it's when he was drawing Little Orphan Annie.
Right.
And you could see him there. So anyway, he was like this guy with this big gray beard. He was like 6'4", this sort of garrulous guy. He kind of reminded me of the director John Huston. He kind of talked like that or whatever. And so we're just trying to imagine, what would that be like as having – that's your dad.
Right.
Like, what was that like? So we're asking her, and Tex is getting embarrassed because his daughter's telling stories. So she finally tells us this story about the time when it was Christmas Eve – and she had to go to bed early because Santa was coming, obviously. And she hears this racket, and there's snow outside. And she's like, what's going on? I don't understand. And so she crawls downstairs, quiet tiptoes, because she doesn't want to disturb anything. And what does she see? Well, her father, Tex, is being visited by his pal, Wally Wood. And Tex and Wally are drunk.
Of course.
And they are outside in the snow peeing for distance.
Yeah, I'm sure I was going to say the story has to involve alcohol somewhere in it.
Like, imagine, you know, being like, and we're like, oh my God. And Texas is like, oh, that didn't really happen. And we're like, well, yeah, it did kind of. We're like, okay.
He's like, let me rephrase. I do not remember that happening.
This visual of Tex playing like this legendary comic book figure, Wally Wood, out there urinating in the snow. It's just like unbelievable. But yeah, I totally agree, Sean, and I am envious of you that you had that experience of being a teacher with him, that you could sort of be at his own level.
And again, I wish I could go back. I mean, forget I want to go back as a student. I was teaching at, what, 23 years old, 24 years old?
Yeah.
And I'm like, God, I barely knew what I was doing myself, much less trying to teach people how to do what I was doing. But like you said, you know, going back to the whole, you know, working for as an artist, but no one knowing who you are. I mean, I worked for Marvel at the time. And it's amazing when you bring it up to people now, because Marvel is such a big deal with the movies that I'm like, oh, I work for Marvel. And people are like, really? I never knew that. I'm like, well, yeah, it was just, you know, his job. And I look back, I'm like, oh, thank God I did that when I was 22, 23, 24 working for Marvel, because I think it scratched that itch of never having to kind of, you know, be 45 years old going, God, I wish I could just work for Marvel just once. And that
really like idolizing,
you know, the jewel in my crown would be to work for Marvel. I'm like, no, I did that. And I did that for years and it was a job. So I can't imagine being this age now and still trying to, you know, grab that brass ring.
I remember many hours sitting on the couch, watching you at your art table, you know, airbrushing Spider-Man and stuff with your Frisket and your X-Acto blades. You sit there and we're like, oh shit, we got to get this package out to FedEx.
Because
of course this is pre-computer and scanning things in or whatever. We had many adventures driving around the town trying to get to FedEx before it closed.
And I I'm really glad I did that when I was young. Cause again, it scratched the itch. It kind of got that out of my system. Like, oh, here's the pinnacle of working for comics is Marvel Comics.
Right.
And it's funny to do that for so many years and then go into commercial work later and going, God, you make so much more money not doing comics.
Yep.
You know, I remember the first big job I had was for like a little rinky dink magazine, and thinking in my head, like, God, if I really, you know, play my cards right, I can get like $400 for this job. And the editor's like, I'm really, really sorry, but we can only pay $1,200 for the whole thing. And I'm like, oh my God, there's money to be made outside comics.
I'm rich, I'm telling you.
It was
rich.
The first time I thought I could really make a living doing it. And I'd already worked for Marvel for years. So it's just weird how I still see people like that at conventions going like, God, if I could just work for Marvel, I could just do one pinup for Marvel, that it would make my whole life. But it's, you know, I think Marvel knows that you want to work for them so bad.
Oh, sure.
They're like, well, we don't have to pay you that much. And unless you're some superstar, it's like, why would we? You know, we got people banging down the door to work for us.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that is, again, one of the benefits of having gone to the school is that you know, it kind of got ordinary, got a little routine. Right. I mean, like I said, I touched a comic book page and I inked a few lines in a comic book. I mean, hell, you and I used to help Mark Pennington finish his Shade pages.
I fill in the blanks.
Couldn't get them done on
over
time.
Chris Bacala, whoever, you know, who knew he was going to be such a superstar, you know, at the time.
And
at that time, you're like, oh my God, this is the best thing I've ever done. If I can sneak my name in the background plants of one of these panels, I'd be all set. And I think also the school did that too, but also you and I working for McNabb afterwards was almost like going to graduate school for comics or art.
Right. That's for anyone that doesn't, we should mention that was the graphic design studio that Sean worked at and our friend Dan Eaker again worked at, and then I worked at, where Mark had Mark's client was Comic Images, which was a manufacturer of all of this licensed material. And so we were doing T-shirts and stand-ups and trading cards for Marvel, 20th Century Fox, MTV, all these different kinds. So, yeah, it absolutely was like a graduate school because you got to, like, literally touch all this stuff.
Well, and I thought it was also better because in school you're taught, I guess, concepts of how to do things. And if you get it wrong on this assignment, you're like, well, screw it. I'll try and do better on the next assignment. Whereas working for Mark, like, no, you got to fix this. You have to figure out how to fix this job now. There was no next time we'll get it better. It was like how you learn how to fix things on the fly. And this, again, this was pre-digital age. You're like learning weird things to do with photocopiers that you and I would never have thought of before that. So I think
I finished many a trading card art because of the foot disappeared or I had to cut a panel off. I had to cut a word balloon out of a Rob Liefeld panel.
Right.
So I had to like finish the musculature because it was missing.
Which again was interesting because then you're really looking like, well, how does Jim Lee draw rock? Because I have to draw rocks behind this thing we cut out. It was interesting to do stuff like that. And again, it taught you more, I think, to be more professional than even the Kubert School itself taught you how to be because you're in the midst of it with a guy who I love, Mark, but he's also one of those guys like if I never had to work for anyone again, it might be him. But if I'd ever want to party with someone, it would be him because he took everything 110% no matter what.
That is true. There's a whole other episode about working for Mark. That's a whole other thing.
I don't know if you read the Exit 6 book, but I wrote about that in there. And I was almost scared to show Mark, like, here's how I felt working for you.
Well, that's the perfect segue because, like I said, we could talk about the Kubert School for hours and hours. And we might even have to do other episodes where we talk just about the Kubert School in general. I wish we had more things to say about Irwin, but I have to admit, like, we just did not take advantage of Irwin's knowledge when we had the time. But nevertheless,
I think because Irwin was a little bit more not checked out, but you know, he was kind of like, well, if you want to learn, I'm here. If you don't, I get paid no matter what.
Yes, exactly.
So, but it seemed like he was kind of in the put Batman in there, or here's the two kind of shots you would use in a gunfight. You know what I mean? Like, here's the hip shot. It was kind of all stuff you could learn in like half an hour of talking to him. And so to really get more knowledge from him, I felt like you would have had to dig deeper.
Yes.
Unfortunately, none of us, I think, were the age or maturity to actually realize we had to do that.
I think that's true. So, we're going to move off, talk about Irwin. As we wrap up here, I do want to give you a chance to talk about what you've been doing because you've always been creating. You've always been doing comic book related stuff. So why don't, as we wrap up here, give everybody just like, what stuff are you working on?
I don't know. You tell them. I just sent you a package. You tell them what you think.
Well, all right. Okay. Sean self-published two different comic books. One was called Exit 6. Which was about a vampire.
Yep. That was something I had concepts for way back when we were in Kubert.
Yeah, well, the original pages. Yeah, the original pages you showed me in that that hot September afternoon in 1989 were Exit 6 pages. You published Exit 6 as a comic book, and now it's collected in a giant edition.
And what I did, I want to go back to kind of, if I can talk about that a little bit, is I think you and I also came out of school, and again, I got bit hard by this, right in the time of everything being independent, everything being...
Yes.
You can do it on your own. You can do it. Whether that was in the music industry where alternative music was coming in with like Nirvana and, you know, the grunge movement, or with movies like Tarantino was coming up and Kevin Smith was coming up, or in comics, you had all these self-publishing coming up with either Bone or even
Strangers in Paradise
or Image. Image like took off the spring of us getting out of school. So it kind of had that whole feeling of like independent is the way to go. So I got bit by that. Even if I was working for Marvel, I still wanted to do my own thing. So, and it's funny too, going back to like you thinking you weren't the best artist in school. I felt that way all the time compared to the people we were around. And I always thought like, if I'm lucky, I may be able to get in with a small publisher like Eclipse or I don't even know who first or one of those, you know, smaller publishers in the 80s. And for me to be like one of the first people I knew who worked at Marvel Comics was weird. So I'm not sure how that happened. But I always wanted to do my own thing. So I actually self-published Exit 6 in, 1998? And based off of Bone being big and Strangers in Paradise being big. And I went through the whole route, which no one really goes through now. Now it's all webcomics. Or let me just put something on Kickstarter and make some money and send it out to people.
Yep.
But I went through the whole let's go to Diamond Distribution and go
comics. Oh, God, yeah.
And I'm like... again, it's one of those like, God, if I was my age now trying to do that, I'm like, oh, there's no way. that stupid thing to do. But it's the, I don't know, arrogance of youth, maybe. You're like, fuck it, let's do it. See what happens. This is the way to go.
Well, that's were the channels that were open to us at that age.
Yeah, there was no web, but now, there was no internet really to speak up to put your art out there.
Right. But now you have another venue, which is your current project, which is the thing I really want to talk about, which is Oil Can Drive. So tell everybody what Oil Can Drive is.
Oil Can Drive is a multimedia thing, pretty much. It's a comic, art, and music. It's about a punk rock band in the futurist wastelands of America who travel along the wastelands in their airship. There's a giant gorilla who plays bass, ex-hockey player plays guitar and sings, an ex-soldier who plays guitar, and a runaway girl who plays drums. And it's pretty much, the concept came when I heard Heavy Metal was looking for submissions. And they wanted stuff that was like 10 to 12 pages long. And at the time, I had no concepts that could fit into such a small space for a story. I had big, this will take, 20 years of my life to finish this 17 right. graphic novels. So I had to come up with a concept that would fit in such small space. And I decided to put everything I love into this comic, which is why you have hockey in it and rock and roll and cute girls and Mad Max wastelands and giant gorillas. And I kind of would do that here and there in between client jobs for years. And I really had no venue for it because I really didn't want to get back into Diamond and try and get back into stores. I had sent it out a couple times to like Image and other publishers and never really heard anything positive back from anybody. I would send it also off to like small press stuff or small, I forget what it was, an Ape was the Alternative Press Expo.
I think so.
Yeah. Had like a mini comics contest. I'm like, oh, I'll send it there. And it's weird because the stuff I do, at least on my own, it's almost in this middling road where it's too slick to be indie and it's not slick enough to be mainstream, which I think wasn't it Kyle Baker who said that's the perfect place to be if you want something commercial. So I started doing web comics with it. So I started reading about web comics and started putting it out there and just putting out books like maybe once a year just for myself. Yeah. So I keep trying to do that. I just had a kid a year and a month ago. So that's kind of slowed production down on everything. I didn't even tell you about San Diego last year, really, in depth. I went out there first time. And when was the last time we went? 2001, 2000, something like that?
Yeah, well, I should mention, Sean and I went to the San Diego Comic-Con together in 98 and 99. And then you've gone other years, and I went one year without you, which that I learned.
But you were there in 2000, though, right? That was the last year I went. It was 2000.
Yeah, and then we went 2001 without you, right. And that's the thing we learned is don't do the San Diego Comic Con without Sean Tiffany because it's no fun at that point.
If you had come out with me last year, it might not have been fun either because it was just crazy.
Well, at the time though, Chris and I went together. We learned very quickly. We're like, this sucks without Sean here. This is no fun. There's another whole episode of the podcast to talk about San Diego Comic Con.
But it had changed. I mean, again, this is the first year I'd been there in 18 years. And it felt a lot different. It felt like comics were just not the thing there anymore.
Oh, right. It's like it's a multimedia. Right.
And I put it down to like, if you love something that's even pop culture related, San Diego has a ton of it. Like if you love Game of Thrones, here's the whole cast of Game of Thrones. And I'm like, how you like Justice League? Here's Ben Affleck and Jason Momoa sitting right, down the hall from me. I'm like, how do you compete with that with your little tiny comic book no one knows?
Right.
And what amazed me is, dude, you would walk into Artist Alley in San Diego, and it was a who's who of famous artists, which at any other convention in the country, they would be like the superstar guest of that Comic-Con. And no one was talking to these guys. Like Art Adams, I just went up and talked to. No one's talking to him. Adam Hughes, no one's talking to him. Kurt Busiek, just sitting by himself, no one talking to him.
Jeez.
And I'm like, how? But then you try and be like, let me try and walk past the Westworld booth. And you're like, I can't even move.
Right.
And so I've never had so many people actively ignore me at a booth ever, like standing next to my booth, like, no, I don't want to know who you are. So it was weird. It definitely changed. But the good thing is what's funny is that people, like two or three people came over to me and remembered me from Exit 6 in 1998.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
They're like, where have you been? We thought you had died. No. Maybe in the comic book world, but, not real life. So it was an interesting trip. And again, it made me want to go back to San Diego when there isn't a Comic-Con. Because everything was...
Oh, yeah. Oh, we love San Diego. I love that town. Yeah.
But, I mean, it's so much busier now. Like, we were, two blocks away from the convention center? And walk from our hotel to the convention center took 45 minutes because you were just inching along.
Yeah.
And every day I'd see this one guy outside panhandling. And I'm like, I bet that guy's making more money than me.
He doesn't have printing costs for his books.
He doesn't have a booth. He doesn't have a booth, you know, cost, nothing.
Well, I'm going to have the link to the Oil Can Drive website in the show notes so people can check it out. You do an old school newsletter, I love that. That is just so fun getting that in the mail. That was like a little segment of the strip. Right. That's really cool.
That was coming from, I don't think I'm the best at social media. I don't know why, because I like to blog. I like to write stuff. I like to show art. But somehow I just can't get a ton of followers. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the hashtag. I don't know. Because a friend's like, you should go on YouTube every day and do YouTube videos. I'm like, I don't want to be another one of those people. You know,
with your voluminous free time.
Exactly. But I like making things. That's what I kind of learned about myself. I really enjoy making stuff. And I miss the days like, you know, you and I came up in the 90s. I miss when you'd like a band and get on their newsletter. You felt like you were part of something when you got that newsletter. So I kind of wanted to go back to that and kind of just do something for my friends and just send it out maybe four times a year with like a link to some music. Here's a strip. You know, here's a little update of what's going on. And it's been fun. I really enjoy it. And one friend's like, well, you could just email these to people. It'd be cheaper. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, my friends are worth 50 cents for a stamp.
I will admit, it really was fun to get that in the mail and you know, peel back the tape and actually have a physical piece of paper in my hand. There's no doubt. I mean, again, I appreciate the fact that you're spending that money, and I wish you almost weren't spending the money. But I have to admit, I enjoyed getting that in the mail. That was a lot of fun.
My hope is if someone, like, even if two people are like, hey, I ordered a book from you. I'm like, that pays for the printing cost, you know. Or for the shipping cost of the stuff I'm sending. And again, it's in a way I can kind of go, well, here's a sticker. Like, I put stickers in the last one. It's kind of fun to do stuff like that where I can make something and not just be like, let me bombard you with, you know, emails and Twitter updates and stuff.
I think I appreciate that. Yeah, it's true. Like I said, you have never not been creating as long as I've known you. I've known you now for, dear God, man, 30 years.
It's like twice our lifetime plus 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, but you have always been creating, and like I said, we've had so many adventures together, and this was really great to finally have a chance to talk to you. I'm glad that it was, like, even though it was something as silly as the Dondi movie, which was the inspiration for this. I'm going to tell everybody, don't bother with the Dondi movie. Don't see it. It's not good. It's not funny at all. I will say, go check out Irwin's art. Like, go to Google and, like, type in Dondi and look up some of his artwork. It's beautiful. It's really nice stuff. I mean, Irwin did some great, great work. And just the fact, talk about being professional, doing a newspaper strip every friggin' day
for 30 years. I couldn't even imagine.
That is unreal, a workload. And so, you know, he is somebody that's probably fallen down the memory hole in a lot of ways, and he shouldn't be, because he was a really great artist, a fun guy. We were very lucky to have spent the time with him that we had, and it was really great. And I'm glad that in a weird way, that it was the movie that was the inspiration to get us to finally do podcast. So
I will say, if you want to see the movie, I'm sure Rob will lend you his copy with no problem, with no expectations of when you get.
Very happy to send you the Dondi movie, please. I don't need to see it ever again. Again, thanks to Chuck Coletta for sending it to me. Well, anyway, Sean, this was just terrific, man. I've been wanting to have you on for the longest time.
Anytime you want to go back and do Kubert stuff or just talk some more, I'd be more than happy to. This is fun.
People love hearing about Joe Kubert school stories, and we have lots of other stories outside of Joe Kubert school as well. We have
many
adventures together.
Who was the last guy you talked to about the Kubert school who was in a class like lower than ours?
Oh, John Trumbull.
When I was teaching, I think, because he mentioned a time when they kind of, like in your and I class, they kind of split us all up.
Yeah.
And I think in John's time, they kind of like, well, let's put all the good guys together and put all.
Oh, that's right. He said there was like an A, B, and C teams.
And I remember at the time they called one class, they called themselves the Gump class, like where the Gumps. I'm like, oh, no. Which I'm like, that's an interesting experiment to try and put everyone kind of in the same league.
Wow.
But I don't know if that, I doubt they kind of kept that going.
Oh, geez. If they had done that for us, you and I never would have had a class together. I would have been completely separate. I would have been in the gum class. There's no doubt about it. So anyway, Sean, this was awesome. Everybody, check out Oil Can Drive. It is a lot of fun. Sean is a great artist. So again, we'll have the link in the show notes. Give it a check. And you say you can go to Amazon and you can buy his books. I have them. They are beautiful volumes, and the story is really fun. And it really is. It's like, it is everything Sean likes in one play.
That's how I explain it.
Music. I mean, the only other thing I could imagine that would be more you is if it was like Bruce Springsteen as a superhero. Like, that would be the other thing, would be that.
Well, there's one more thing I wanted to say before you sign off, before we kind of stop recording, is, Rob, I am super duper proud of you for just the person you are. And I was thinking about this morning, like, you have never...
I'm going to edit this. I'm editing this.
Don't edit this out. This is this best thing, because you may feel like sometimes you don't succeed, but in my eyes, you've never failed in anything you've done. You set yourself out to be an artist and you became an artist. Everything I've seen you do with the Aquaman shrine, I was one of those people who knew it when it was on the wall in the apartment we lived in. You know, I saw the first. So for you to bring something that was just sitting on your wall and you going, I'm going to collect everything Aquaman I can, to how big you made that online amazes me. And then to take that love and turn it into, I'm going to turn it into a bunch of blogs. And then to turn that into a bunch of podcasts. I am super proud of you for what you've done. And I'm really amazed at what you've done. So I just wanted to say that on the record. Don't edit that out.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. That's very nice of you to say. So we're going to end it here because we're getting
we're going to start hugging and slobbering over each other soon enough here.
Yeah, this is not good. We don't need that. Thank God we're in different cities. So everybody, anyway, Sean, thank you so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. Erwin, wherever you are, thank you so much for being our instructor.
Happy 100 years. Happy 100 years.
Happy 100 years, Erwin, wherever you are, wherever part of the universe you're in, whether it's Oa or wherever the hell you might be. Again, happy 100th birthday, Erwin. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. Check out Oil Can Drive. Again, a link in the show notes. And, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. Let us know what you think of this episode. If you want to hear more, come to the website, fireandwaterpodcast.com, and leave us a comment. So, again, thanks, everybody, for listening. Happy birthday, Erwin, and we will see you later. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Dundee, oh, Dundee, think of birds in the sky. Or a rainbow on high, that's Dundee, little Dundee, with a song in his heart and a star in his eyes, that's Dundee, little Dundee. His smile can chase the clouds and brighten skies above, and every empty heart he'll fill up with love. That's Dundee, little Dundee, all the world's sunny joy stored in one little port. There's no one else like you.
Bet you glad you General Bow. Here's some money for your clothes.
Hey, you! Ted, come here!
And every empty heart he'll fill up with love. Dundee, little Dundee, all the world's sunny joy stored in one little boy. That's Dundee, little Dundee. There's no one else like you. Yeah.